You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.
You're listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today I'm joined again by Jill Greening. Welcome back, and thanks so much for recording with me today.
Thanks for having me, Olivia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jill Greening is a dance artist and writer. Her work moves within and between performance and text to explore memory, temporality, and embodiment via methods of mark-making, scoring, and sensory-oriented documentation. Her work has been presented through Toronto's A-Space Gallery, MAWA, and Plugins, ICA's Summer Institute. She has participated in VideoPool's New Artists in Media Residency and Festival Transamérique Conversations on Performance program. She holds a Master's in Theatre and Performance Studies from York University. For January, I will be covering different anthology horror films, and this week, Jill and I are discussing Masaki Kobayashi's 1964 anthology film, Koidan. Of four separate and unrelated Japanese folk tales, with the vignettes representing four seasons of the year. The film is an adaptation of four stories from the book Koidan, Stories and Studies of Strange Things, by Lafcadio Hearn from 1904. The film starts with Black Hair, where a poor samurai divorces his true love to marry for money, but finds the marriage disastrous and returns to his old wife, only to discover something eerie about her. The two happily exchange wonderful stories about the past and the future until the swordsman falls asleep. He wakes up the following day only to discover that he had been sleeping next to his ex-wife's rotted corpse. Rapidly aging, he stumbles through the house, finding that it actually is in ruins and overgrown with weeds. He manages to escape, only to be attacked by his ex-wife's black hair. The next segment is called Women in the Snow, where stranded in a snowstorm, Minokichi, a woodcutter, meets an icy snow spirit, or a Yukiona. She spares his life on the condition that he never tell anyone about her. Minokichi returns home and never mentions that night. One day, while cutting wood, he comes across Yuki, a beautiful young woman. The two marry and have children, living happily. Years later, Minokichi tells Yuki about the strange encounter. It is then that she reveals herself to be the Yukiona, and a snowstorm comes over the home. Despite the fact he broke his word, she refrains from killing him because of their children. Yuki then leaves Minokichi with the children, warning him to treat them well or she'll return to kill him. She disappears into the snowstorm, leaving Minokichi heartbroken. The following segment is Hoichi the Earless. So Hoichi is a blind musician living in a monastery who sings so well that a ghostly imperial court commands him to perform the epic ballad of their death in battle for them. The tale of the Heike about the battle Danura fought between the Tara and the Minamoto clans during the last phase of the Genpei War. But the ghosts are draining away his life, and the monks set out to protect him by writing the text of the Heart Sutra on his body, including his face, to make him invisible to the ghosts. The samurai reappears and calls out to Hoichi. Hoichi does not appear. Unfortunately, the monks have forgotten to write the holy text on his ears, and they are visible to the samurai. The samurai, wanting to bring back as much of Horiichi as possible, rips his ears off to show his lord his commands have been obeyed. The final segment is called In a Cup of Tea. Anticipating a visit from his publisher, our writer relates an old tale of a man who keeps seeing a mysterious face reflected in his cup of tea. Publisher soon arrives and asks the madam for the author, who is nowhere to be found. They both flee the scene in terror when they discover the author trapped inside a large jar of water. So, Jill, what is your history with Kwaiden?
I watched it back in high school or in early university years in a Japanese Criterion phase, as one has.
Been there, yeah.
But then this rewatch was really such a beautiful refresher. Like, this film is so poetic. Mm-hmm. And as someone who loves seeing live performance and obviously hasn't been able to because of COVID, watching Kwaiden was really this like important reminder of how certain live theater elements can be incorporated so effectively through a screen. So like the influence of no theater in this film through pacing and thematic content and gesture and embodiment feels really hopeful and exciting for someone like me who is pivoting performance practices towards kind of more like digital and video oriented formats.
So
beautiful and really felt really special to kind of watch it in this current time. What about you?
Yes, it's my first time watching Kwaiden. Friend of the show, Nick Liang, suggested it to me a while ago, and it was featured in the horror anthology documentary, Tales of the Uncanny, so I'm happy to have finally seen it. This was also my first time watching a Masaki Kobayashi film, too. I really enjoyed the surreal and uncanny theater-like quality of the stories, and like you said, the film incorporates theater elements in a really interesting way. I don't necessarily always like theater or plays, but I do like theater elements in films. So the first two stories, The Black Hair and The Woman of the Snow, are my favorite segments. Horiichi the Earless and In a Cup of Tea didn't resonate with me as much, probably because they don't feature a vengeful ghost woman. It's a really beautiful and poetic film. I just wish I could see it in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a great experience to see it in a theater.
Oh, I can't. And because of it being so widescreen too, like, because even where I was watching it on DVD, which is like, I usually am so watching things on my laptop, like right up here.
Yeah.
So I was watching it on a TV screen. Yeah. But even then it was like, no, this needs like a bigger situation.
Yeah, you need to be like immersed in it.
Yeah.
I just want to talk a little bit about anthology films before we get started. So an anthology film is a subgenre of films consisting of several different short films, often tied together only by a single theme, premise, or brief interlocking event. So I have a brief description here, or a quote from popmatters.com. So the anthology or portmanteau horror film has been a popular variant within the horror genre for many years. Britain's Ealing Studios introduced the format with their multi-director effort Dead of Night from 1945, and the British production company Amicus made the format their own during the 1960s and 1970s, producing titles such as The House That Dripped Blood from 1971 and Asylum from 1972. Unlike the portmanteau horror films produced by the likes of Amicus, Kwaiden does not feature a wraparound framing device that connects each story in some way. Each story is presented as being distinct from the others. Two formal commonalities that the stories do share are the on-screen title text that appears just as they are at the beginning, and the presence of an unseen narrator who informs viewers of each tale's basic premise. Jill, are you a fan of anthology films?
I mean, I generally like anthology collections, whether it's like short stories or poems, and this like migration into film feels really natural to me. One of my favorite childhood activities, we would do it in my class every year. I went to a hippie school where we would create poetry anthologies every year, and it was like figuring out these like distinct sensations that would be captured on each page was so fun and exciting for me. So I love being offered kind of a collection of worlds that I can draw linkages between, whether desired or intended by the publisher or director or not.
Mm-hmm.
Just the other week, For Christmas, as one does, I watched Creepshow, and it's just like so fun, and it's such a good format for delving into like different imaginary spaces. It's good for this format tends to be good for like if you're with other people in your social. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd recommend doing the social thing with quite Anne.
Yes.
But
yeah.
for Creepshow, it was really nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I grew up reading short stories, short horror stories like Arl Stein and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, and watching shows like Are You Afraid of the Dark and so Weird Stories. But I don't have much experience with anthology films. However, I do really like Creepshow and Twilight Zone. And in researching anthologies for this month, it's just been really cool to see how creative filmmakers are able to be within the shorter format. And it seems like the filmmakers are able to be to take more risks and tell weirder stories than maybe compared to like a feature length narrative. And I'm not really sure if that's like because of budget reasons or because some anthologies feature like different filmmakers able to sort of produce different works under the same like in the same collection. But yeah, it's just been really cool to see that. Yeah, I was listening to a Criterion Channel interview with Guillermo del Toro about Quaidan, which is one of his favorite movies, and he described it as a very modern movie, I think, in terms of filmmaking, lighting, camera work, and design, and also as an artifact of ancient folktales. And I think that's such an interesting element of the film, that it uses very modern filmmaking techniques to tell these ancient Japanese ghost stories.
Yes, totally. I also really love how these themes of storytelling and retelling flow through many of the films within Quaidan. I mean, like, first off, as you said, Kobayashi was working off of Herden's collection of Japanese folktales.
Mm-hmm.
So there's already this beautiful removal or twice told experience of oral storytelling moving to the page and then to the screen. And then The Woman in the Snow features a story which almost cost a man his life. I mean, granted, it's not so much a story, but the telling of an experience, mm-hmm. or a memory. And then Hoishi, the earless, features a man who is sought after and put in grave danger due to his ability to tell this very well-known and often-told tale of the Heike clan. And In a Cup of Tea uses this like framework of writing stories to tell of the tale of a doomed writer. So, to be honest, as someone who lives with like near constant deadline dread, I did feel a certain kinship with the writer who was left or was snatched from his unfinished tale and discovered trapped in this like kind of cauldron,
yeah,
kettle cup situation. And then not to mention the fact that some of these stories, like The Woman in the Snow, have iterations that exist from around the globe. Like as a kid, I remember I had a book that told this Inuit tale that ran parallel with an icy kind of Arctic ocean spirit who raised a family on land and spared her husband's life. So yeah, I mean, I totally agree that Quaidan functions so beautifully as like an artifact or even like an archive of, mm-hmm. these tales.
Yeah, and like the element or the idea of an archive is also sort of discussed in Hoichi the Earless, in that he's like, the archive of this tale, this battle, is being told like in this song and this way of like storytelling, and then it's also bringing these soldiers and this emperor back to life through the storytelling.
I have never seen Quaidan. What should I expect?
Well, Quaidan by Masaki Kobayashi is a crucial film, again, for me. And the reason I chose it is multi-tiered, because it's based on the stories of one of my favorite writers of all times, Lafcadio Hearn. Hearn is a very peculiar writer. He has an Irish father, a Greek mother. He chronicles Japan for the West. You know, he makes accessible Japanese myth and the richness of their culture, and his fables are full of passion. The stories are based on a book of his called Quaidan, which also is one of my favorites because part of it is insect lore and the other part is ghost stories.
Perfect.
So what's not to like, you know? It's an eminently modern movie and also an artifact of ancient roots because it's based on ancient ghost tales of Japan. One of his tales is one of the most beautiful paradoxes on ghost / fairy tales, The Woman in the Snow. It's a fairy tale that is both incredibly scary and incredibly beautiful, and talks about love and death with equal passion. Kobayashi was one of the most renowned filmmakers in Japan at the time, but he was also incredibly stubborn, and his quest to do Kwaidan the way he wanted to do it, and at the scale and the inventiveness he wanted to do it, it is not an enterprise that he rationally should have tackled. And he goes against all that and makes what I consider one of the most perfect films artistically I've ever seen. And his influence is felt in my own work in the fact that the inventiveness the film has with color and shape and filmmaking is unrivaled. He goes completely not analog about the way he treats colors or landscape. All of a sudden you have a sky full of eyes watching human foibles that has a transcendental, crazy value spiritually, but visually is insane. And then he goes into a color palette that is of a purity equal to painting or engraving. If you have never seen it, and this is going to be your first time, you're in for an absolute treat because it's a film for all times.
Yeah, so just want to talk a little bit about production design because it's really interesting to me. So Kwaidan was filmed in a repurposed airplane hangar and has a very like intentionally artificial quality. And like we mentioned before, like very theater-like. So I have a quote here from BFI.org. Kwaidan was the most expensive Japanese film ever made up to that time, and it shows. Along with art director Shigemasa Toba, set designer Dai Arakawa, and cinematographer Yoshiya Miyajima, Kobayashi creates a vast, expressionistic fairy tale world unlike any other scene in cinema. Shot almost entirely on giant sets built inside an airplane hangar, the style of Kwaidan is deliberately strikingly artificial. Here, huge eyes gaze out of painted winter skies upon man-made lakes and snow-dusted forests of symmetrically planted trees.
Yes, I do. I feel like this kind of encapsulates like the source of my live performance excitement with mm-hmm. this film. Like, there's definitely this sense of a stage, not so much like a proscenium arch. Mm-hmm. Or whatever, and it's definitely a departure from naturalism, but this mm-hmm. notion of an omnipotent gaze where we as a viewer are free to roam our eyes around the screen. And there is a certain objectivity with which Kobayashi films that invites the viewer to get a sense of the entire picture. Mm-hmm. So I also love how in The Woman in the Snow, the forest scenes remind me of The Wizard of Oz, where mm-hmm. there's this like horribly spooky forest for the poppy fields and the Emerald City. And perhaps it's also the mixing of mediums, mm-hmm. like having the kind of psychedelic painted backgrounds with the drama and movement in the foreground. I suppose this could be taken further as in The Woman in the Snow, there are these large eyes that look upon the men gathering wood and in turn gaze on us, the viewer. And it imparts this reciprocal exchange of knowledge. Like we're both observing this story in a sense. And in storytelling, too, each teller leaves its imprint on the next telling. So Kobayashi is, in a sense, like leaving this imprint of contemporaneity in his recreation of these organic materials mm-hmm. and these expressive sets. Like, it is this, like, yeah, to think of, like, this archive, it's, like, his imprint on this moment or on these mm-hmm. these stories and these tellings of these stories, which is, like, So it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I just love it. Yeah. And the film's sound design also contributes to the film's overall uncanniness. It's a very quiet film with a few sequences scored very like otherworldly, unnatural music cues. For example, at the end of Black Hair, the samurai is realizing that his wife is actually a rotten corpse and the house is decaying. This scene is scored with a very haunting violin and these sort of broken, unnatural drum sounds. Or it almost sounds like they're breaking wood or something. Like, it's hard to place, but it's also synced up with the samurai's actions. So it's like scoring his movements and his actions. And it's, yeah, it's just very, very cool. So I have a quote here from sensesofcinema.com. Complementing these dazzling, almost hallucinatory visuals is Toru Takemitsu's bold and modern soundtrack, which deftly avoids the cliches of conventional film music, especially in the case of the horror film, in which the score usually underscores the images with conventionally melodramatic music. Takemitsu's score uses expressionist sounds and bizarre instrumentation interspersed with sections of uneasy quiet and deliberately disarms the spectator, while simultaneously weaving a spell that draws the viewer further into Kobayashi's colorful and highly stylized realm.
It's so interesting to hear that when, yeah, the sound in this film is, like, so exceptional. And you talking about these unnatural drum sounds that, like, kind of coincide yet strangely and bizarrely, or, like, there's an akimbo or off-centeredness with how they coincide with this music. His movements. And then when working on my research for this, I got really intrigued by the Japanese notion of ma. M-A, yeah. Which is a concept of negative space. And it's this idea that it's the spaces in between notes or the sounds in between words that are considered kind of the heart of the work. Mm-hmm. So the notion of ma also holds the idea that these gaps or pauses are where possibility exists. So rather than perceiving these spaces as a void or something of the sort, it's rather a space for knowledge or for affect. So it's so thrilling to watch this film through a heightened perception to the silences and the spaces and the gaps and the unseen. So in Black Hair, the viewer is often shown scenes of long grasses blowing in the wind. That happens before, I think it's like the first bit when we're seeing their home, like we see these waving grasses, and then again when we're seeing it as this kind of decrepit place where it's transitioning into that as it does. So it's this motion that's caused by like the hidden catalyst of the wind. And I also really love thinking about the hair in the same way. So while we so often we see it in a lot of these segments, the like long hair of women in these like thick columns down their back, whereas black hair forces that slick kind of control into chaos, allowing the viewer to think on how each single strand of hair exists in this series or pattern of spaces, which was kind of like liberatory and probably really exciting for me. The Women of the Snow, the viewer is invited into a world bracketed by the torrents of nature. There's heavy snowfall and a forest thick with trees, and we're hyper aware of the wood gatherer's space within this stringent natural architecture. And it really, I went for a run, too long of a run the other day in like heavy snow, and there was this really strange sensation of like a lone body kind of moving through this like lone white space, like not really being able to see much ahead of you, and it's like you're just like moving through this white neutral zone. I know neutral is like a problematic term in a lot of body contexts, but it was so bizarre and so strange. And this film, like, kind of, there's like an anxiety involved with that, but also like a liberation. It's a very strange, strange feeling. So that film really kind of summoned that for me. And then in Hoishi the Earless, there's like, it's perhaps obviously the most like sonically obvious with its use of ma. And the viewer or listener is really drawn to be attuned to the structure of his playing and to the silences, like when his ears get torn off and know that he's like supposed to be silent, otherwise they'll know or whatever.
Yeah.
And so we're so heightened to our awareness of sounds that he is perhaps making internally or desires to hear, whatever. Yeah. It's like this sensory awareness that's so vivid. And then In a Cup of Tea has this like beautiful use of shadow where there's an awareness to the shapes in space that are unseen or present in a different kind of way. So they're there and they're moving, but yet they're unseen, but tracked only by these shadows along the white compound walls. So whether we want to think about this as like they're in this other realm, I know in like No Theater it was like usually like a bridge rather than like a path that connected the spiritual realm. But being able to see like when he's fighting those like three gods of the different colored robes at the end, there's like this power in their shadow presence that really palpable. So while the notion of Ma could be like a sound-based element that's prominent in definitely in all the tales, I found it so rich and exciting to explore it through other like sensory lenses. And I mean, I suppose it could also link into the space left in the story of the final tale. It is like this unfinished space of possibility that's left by the writer. So yeah, something about this film is like this like beautiful spaciousness, capaciousness that I'm like left with that I just love.
Yeah, it's so well done.
Ah!
Yeah, and like we mentioned earlier, Koidan is a collection of Japanese ghost stories. So I have a quote here from electricliterature.com. Japan lives with its ghosts like few other cultures. Since ancient times, Japan's religion and culture has been deeply bound with ghosts called yurei. Both feared and revered, yurei are part of the deep magic, a foundational belief that humans have a god inside them. This powerful supernatural entity, called Reikon or Tamashi, is held in check only by the meat cocoon of the body. On death, a spirit is unleashed, for good or ill. If properly respected with the correct rituals, a person's spirit becomes a protective ancestor deity, called Kami or Sorai. But if something goes wrong, if the spirit has some lingering business, or if death rites are not properly performed, then a yurei is born. And I think it's really interesting how in all the stories, in all four stories, nothing is really explained. Like, it's all left up to interpretation. Like, even in, yeah, Black Hair, it's not necessarily that the first wife is vengeful. Because, like, when you see her, she seems very sympathetic. And then the hair attacks, and there's no explanation why. And even, yeah, with the woman in the snow, there's no explanation for that. And, yeah, it's just really well done and surreal and spooky and weird. And yeah, I was reading about it, and apparently American audiences didn't like it very much when it came out. They were expecting something more like Godzilla, unfortunately. I think it's just, yeah.
I'm glad it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know, there's something so nice about, and I mean, yeah, I'm thinking of that last story where it literally articulates this unfinishedness, but I think it goes more than that, where in certain like Western or like fable mythology, we're so used to it being like, and that's good, that's bad, that's how it goes.
Like, yeah, there's a lesson associated with it, which I guess in the first two, like in Black Hair, it's like, don't leave your poor wife because you want to be rich. That's a good lesson. And then the second one is like, don't be a gossip.
yeah, but it's also, it's more that it's complex, and it's like, yeah, there is no like, just like, this is the one parable that we're leaving you with, and that's that. It's like, no, they are these stories that you're meant to chew on, you're meant to think about, and knowing too, in thinking again of like no theater, where so much of it is based on like Shinto or Buddhist tales, like, yeah, there is like a just a different resonance that they are meant to be here, which is done so
well. And there's also sympathy for the spirits, especially in Hoichi, the earless. I don't necessarily think that they're malicious spirits, even though they ripped that guy's ears off, but... also have a bit of an explanation on Yuki-onna, or the snow spirit. So the Yuki-onna appears on snowy nights as a tall, beautiful woman with long black hair and blue lips. Her inhumanly pale or even transparent skin makes her blend into the snowy landscape. She often wears a white kimono, but other legends describe her as nude and only her face and hair standing out against the snow. Despite her inhuman beauty, her eyes can strike terror into mortals. She floats across the snow, leaving no footprints. In fact, her eyes can strike terror... Oh, no. In fact, some tales say that she has no feet, a feature of many Japanese ghosts, and she can transform into a cloud of mist or snow if threatened. So this spirit, which appears in Woman of the Snow, is a very early example of the long-haired vengeful ghost that can be seen in contemporary Japanese cinema like Ringu and Ju-on. And I think seeing where this trope comes from is very interesting.
Yeah, it's so fascinating thinking of that trope. And I was doing a bit of, when looking into no theater, doing a bit naturally into Buto, which I'm such a fan of, and I've been fortunate to see a couple performances or videos of, but how those sorts of like very, well, no, obviously being traditional, Buto being obviously more experimental, but how that has creeped into a lot of like Japanese horror. Like, and so thinking of this hair is one that is so emblematic of Japanese horror, like Ring obviously being the one that is like most vivid for me. But yeah, it's like,
yeah, it's
cool. It's such a such a potent image.
Yeah. And if you think of like how hair is seen even in like Western cultures, like it's such a like gendered, sexualized, like coveted object essentially. And then just to see it sort of like twisted into this, like in one of the segments, like basically a creature on its own. And then, yeah, for it to be like this enticing sort of creepy element of this vengeful spirit. I just like it. I just like anything that is like usually deemed like very sexualized to be like turned around like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this anthology does that. I feel like some of the stories in it like does it so well.
Mm-hmm.
So something that I did find interesting, because it's something that you really feel with each of these film segments, is there is a pacing that is definitely not utilized or not normalized within like Western film media.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and again, looking into like no theater, finding this pacing, it's Jo Ha Kyu, so Jo-Ha-Kyu. And so basically it's like, it's where you have a beginning. It's like the kind of the first act.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, set up story. Mm-hmm. And then you have break for like four acts. Mm-hmm. Of like kind of slow, like kind of movement and action happening, but mm-hmm. it's subtle action. Like it's still kind of on this certain plane. Mm-hmm. And then there's a rapid action in the last act, and then it's done.
Oh,
so it is compared to like a Western formatting where mm. I was showing you Olivia before, I don't have the language for it. I just have these gestures to show like a different sort of triangle movement. Whereas this is a little
doesn't
bit
really
more,
work for radio.
Whereas this is a bit more like a kind of subtle waving until the kind of rapid action at the end. So, and we really felt that, like, honestly, in Hoshi the Your list, like, I was like, wait, what is it over? Like, it's such a different pacing than I'm used to, especially for these kind of shorter anecdotal tales.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're used to I'm used to a very particular pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So then when it was over, it was just like, oh, yeah, all this rapid action. Oh, and then these people visit him, and now he's about to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Or especially that segment where it's like, there's this battle scene, and so there's that chunk of action, and then the story is like slowly build, and you get like some character development and figure out what's happening, and then this scene, and then it's over.
Exactly, mm-hmm. totally. It's like that rapidness at the end, and mm-hmm. like before that, this like kind of slow waving detail,
mm-hmm.
subtle oriented, like slow moving kind of build.
Mm-hmm.
Which completely makes you think about time.
Mm-hmm.
Differently as you're sitting and watching it too, which is fun.
Yeah.
When time is such a weird thing.
I know, yeah. And yeah, like I was reading about how time is portrayed in this film. And yeah, like I mentioned earlier, how it covers like four different seasons. And
yes.
I believe the months that are covered are September, December, March, and February.
Beautiful.
That's kind of what I came across in my research. And yeah, it is interesting to think of these as like seasonal stories.
It makes sense, even in thinking of I have all my manga notes
mm-hmm.
that I will cherish forever.
Yeah.
And thinking of like the grasses
mm-hmm.
in Black Hair, that's mm-hmm. a fall kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
There is a dryness to
yeah.
it and like a crackliness.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Koishi the Earless, there's mm-hmm. like even that last image that we see with the like shrine or the graveyard
mm-hmm.
or whatever where he was playing. There's like a spring, like
it's
rejuvenation.
Spring,
everything's
yeah.
quite green.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm trying to think in the final one, that would be what month?
February, which I believe is the time of New Year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which makes sense because it is set. It's like New Year's Day. That
mm-hmm.
it's gone. Interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, then there is that sense of play, which I just, those girls in the street.
Oh
those,
yeah, yeah.
Playing like that ping pong, but it's
like a tennis style thing.
Yeah, yeah.
In the street.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And which then also alludes to this kind of cyclical mm-hmm. nature of it, but it, there's a continuity with it.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, so that's it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. And thank you, Jill. Thank you so much for coming back and talking about this movie with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always so, so nice to talk with you about these films.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to finally watch this movie. So thank you, Nick Liang, and thank you, Rob Gardner, for your Criterion Channel login info.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Yeah, you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 o'clock on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. It's also available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and wherever you listen to podcasts. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.